Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today, during this Christmas New Year's break, we will continue to look back on the stories that dominated the headlines in this tumultuous year of 2020, which is fast coming to a close. This year saw mounting evidence of climate change impacting the environment in destructive ways that add to the pace of global warming, in particular, the massive forest fires. We begin with a broadcast from January the 8th, when we went to Australia to speak with that country's leading novelist, Richard Flanagan, the winner of the Man Booker Prize, whose latest book is First Person. He joined us to discuss his recent article at the New York Times, Australia is Committing Climate Suicide, and elaborate on his comparison of a continent on fire to the collapse of the Soviet Union as Australia is becoming the Chernobyl of the climate crisis. With its appalling leadership void and a media dominated by Rupert Murdoch, Australia will never be the same lucky country, as now its angry populace is poised to rise up from the ashes and take back their country after having been abandoned by the useless global warming denying politicians in the pockets of coal barons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Flanagan.
Thank you, Ian.
Well, it's a pleasure, Richard, and your piece in the New York Times recently really got my attention. And is it the case, as some people have written in to the New York Times, picking up on your suggestion, that Australia is the Chernobyl of climate crisis?
Well, that was the analogy I drew in the article, and I drew it for several reasons. One is because this is the first time, I think, that we've had a catastrophe which can be directly linked to climate change affecting the majority of a developed nation or the majority of the population of a developed nation. And in consequence, and it's a rolling crisis, it's not a single event, it's events that began some months ago and it's going to continue for several months more. And I think it's leading people all across Australia to fundamentally question the direction the country's taken. There is a great and growing anger with the leadership of the country, which seems to, in the eyes of many, have betrayed the people, both in its response to actually dealing with the fires and its preparation for the fires, and also more fundamentally in the way it's been working for nearly a quarter of a century now to subvert and deny any attempt at climate change mitigation, both internationally and within Australia. Australia does feel, and this may sound far-stretched, but I was recently in Eastern Europe, and I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe from the 1980s on, and it feels very reminiscent to me of Eastern Europe in the 1980s. You have these Brezhnevian leaders who look like they've been there forever, they're old, they're completely out of touch with reality. They're imprisoned in the sclerotic madnesses of their ideology, and they're supported by a monstrous propaganda machine, in the case of the political establishment in Australia, by the Murdoch press, which has virtually a monopoly in all major cities. And at the same time, you seem to have a very compliant population, and change seems impossible. But it's like some vast glacier where nothing moves and nothing moves, and then finally it carves some huge iceberg. In fact, Havel used this extraordinary image after the Velvet Revolution, where he described dissidents. He described going to a bridge where there was a frozen river, and each night he'd go to the bridge and he'd see another candle being lit beneath the ice. And he'd go back the next night and there'd be another candle and another, but still the river was frozen over. And then one night he went there and the river was flowing free again. And I think that's what's beginning to happen in Australia. You're seeing more and more people speaking out, whether it's a firefighter pulling up and jumping out and telling the media in very direct language what he thinks of the Prime Minister, whether it's a pregnant woman who refuses to shake the Prime Minister's hand, whether it's one of the most senior firefighting figures in Australia who has basically called bullshit on the Prime Minister. It goes on and on and on. People are standing up and there is a change in the mood, and people recognise that the fires like Chernobyl, in the end, are a symbol for something much more fundamentally wrong with their system. And change is possible. Change will happen. I think that's undoubted. Change will happen. The question is whether it's change for the better or change for the worse, but something transformational is happening in this summer of fire in Australia, and it's something I've only ever experienced before in Eastern Europe in the 1980s. It's a situation I've not seen in my life in Australia before, where you suddenly feel that the government and the people have fundamentally diverged. And I'm not sure what happens when the fire ends, but Australia is transformed forever after this event. I think there can be little doubt of that.
Well, clearly there's an appalling leadership void. Not that that's not a kind of tradition. I mean, going back, there was a book written many years back called The Lucky Country that sort of suggested that Australia's always had mediocre political leadership, with a couple of rare exceptions. But the one that Australia has now is particularly out of touch. He was recently booed, as your article mentioned, in the town of Cobargo that was actually my mother's hometown, where she grew up, that was largely burned to the ground, and he was booed by the residents. But he does seem to be a kind of composite of Trump's denial, Pence's piety, and Bolsonaro's contempt for the environment. How would you describe him?
Well, I think he's sort of the Neville Chamberlain of climate change. He's a man who went into our parliament waving around a lump of coal, telling Australians not to be scared. I think Australians are terrified now. He pursued a policy not simply of appeasement, but of collaboration with the coal and gas industries. And Australia is now the largest exporter in the world of coal and of gas. And although Australia's emissions 1.3% of the world's, by 2030, we will be a producer, if you include our exports, a producer of, it will be the sixth largest producer in the world of carbon emissions, if we include exports. That there's a very close relationship between the fossil fuel industries and the Conservative Party, and Morrison's been a leading cheerleader for those companies. Morrison won a close election here in no small part because of the support given him by a coal oligarch called Clive Palmer, who formed a puppet party, the United Australia Party, on which he then spent over double the combined advertising budgets of the two major parties, the Labor and Liberal parties, in order to keep Labor out of power. Labor had a limited but real climate change agenda, or climate action agenda. And Palmer has plans to build a huge coal mine in the Galilee Basin, the plans for which he submitted shortly after the election. And this government owes Palmer its power. They're heavily indebted to him, and they're going to try and deliver everything he wants and that the other fossil fuel companies want. What should be happening in Australia is there should be an end to the extraordinary subsidies to the fossil fuel industries, which amount to about $1,200 US per person. There should be a moratorium on any new coal or gas developments, and we should clean up our own act locally. We're currently, if we're the leading exporter in the world of coal and gas, we're also ranked 57th out of 57 countries on climate change action, and we need to improve vastly and rapidly. And then if our country is to have any chance in the future, and I think this is the realisation that's sinking in Australia, that our very viability as a nation is now under threat because of climate change. And if the scientists' predictions are right, and the scientists predicted everything that's happening here many years ago, and if the scientists are right about the future, and there's every reason to think they would be, given they've been so right in the past, their predictions are that if we continue on the present trajectory, which globally is for 3 Celsius or above increase in temperatures, most of mainland Australia will be uninhabitable within 80 years. And so if we're to have a future, we need to clean up our own act and then go out and fight as hard as we can to be a global leader, persuading the rest of the planet to join with us. Because what you're seeing in Australia is simply a wake-up call to the rest of the rest of the world. What you're saying in Australia is the future.
And you mentioned the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, showing up in Parliament with a chunk of coal and accusing the opposition party of coalophobia. As recently as November, his Deputy Prime Minister, who, as you point out in your article, blamed these fires on exploding horse manure, he's calling climate activists inner-city raving lunatics. What is going on, though, with legislation that is kind of Orwellian and scary, in the sense that they want to literally criminalise peaceful protests by environmentalists?
There's a whole range of legislation being proposed in various stages of enactment which seek to criminalise democracy. And what's interesting with Morrison, who really made his name as the immigration minister who perfected the system of cruelty against refugees, which is known in Australia as the Pacific Solution, whereby refugees were interned in hellish Pacific islands, is that the same combination of a complete indifference to human suffering, a contempt for democratic processes, a culture of secrecy. All these same tactics are now being applied to try and crush questioning, discussion and democratic opposition to the crisis that's affecting Australia. And I think really what you see in Australia is a growing wall between the voice of the of coal and gas versus the voice of the people. And one of the... I cannot convey to you enough the enormous sense of sadness and grief that is affecting so many people here, because what we're seeing is an extraordinarily beautiful world. Australia has the most beautiful natural world, and Australians have a very strong connection with it. And it's vanishing all around us this summer. And much of it will never be the same again. It will never come back. There's just an enormous sadness for everybody in this. To get to your point, when that starts expressing itself politically, this grief, this anger, this rage, that the government is going to use all the forces of the state to try and deny it, to suppress it, and to imprison those who seek to voice it. In my own home state of Tasmania, there's now legislation pending that will see environmental protesters go to jail for up to 21 years. This is the stuff of tyrannies. It's impossible to believe it's happening in my own country, and yet it is.
But surely there will be a backlash of people power. If you say that the country is in a state of grief, and frankly, a lot of the world is in a state of grief. You know, the koala is an iconic animal. 1 billion koalas and kangaroos and other animals have apparently been burned alive in all of these fires, which, as you point out, will go on for at least a month. Everybody's feeling the pain, and surely there will be a political response. I mean, as draconian as these laws are, can they pass them in an environment where the majority...
As we were talking about at the beginning, it does feel like a Chernobyl moment, and it was Gorbachev who wrote many years later that the collapse of the Soviet Union began with the Chernobyl crisis. And I think things are going to change rapidly. They may go subterranean for a while, but I don't think people will feel they have a choice, because they're not being offered the necessary change they know they need if we are to continue in a viable form into the future. I mean, this feels to many Australians like a fundamental crisis. You know, it feels like a war, except it's not entirely clear who the enemy is. Just to clarify a point about the number of animals dead, scientists estimated about 2 weeks ago, I think, that it was 500 million animals. Mm-hmm. But they now think that estimate is a severe underestimate. They also think many species, both plant, animal, and even some birds, may well be extinct in consequence. And so there's a massive ecocide happening at the same time.
And there's also the huge economic impact it's going to have on the country. And people are going to feel it very directly because vast areas of Australia are going to become uninsurable. This is going to have consequences that ripple through commerce, industry and finance.
But if you can't breathe the air in Sydney, isn't that being immediately felt? I mean, what do people do when the air is 10 times above the safe limit?
I think in the short, I mean, people seek to evade it, but you know, they stay inside, they wear masks, and they get angry. You know, they also, you know, there's a high level of growing stress and worry associated with this. And in the end, that starts manifesting itself as anger. And ultimately, I think it'll lead to the sort of things we're already seeing, which is these public shows of contempt for political leaders. And I've never seen that in Australia before.
And does that extend, though, to the Labor Party? Because your article mentions that that Labor has been friendly to the coal lobby and the coal barons, and they were, I don't know whether it's about jobs. You know, it's the same thing here in this country. And, of course, Trump is like Morrison. He didn't hold up a piece of coal, but he keeps talking about wonderful clean coal, which is an absurd lie and an oxymoron. So would this mean that the only people left in Australian politics would be the Greens that have any respect?
Well, I think the Labor Party is still a major party. Its record on these issues is mixed. Unlike the Conservative Party here, it's not captive to the climate denialists. The people in the Labor Party accept the science of climate change. And they went to the last election with a reasonable, if limited, policy on climate change action. Where they fall down is that they continue to take money from the fossil fuel industries and they continue to support their development. And I think the debate will be shifting very quickly after these fires finally end. To recognising the need to having to wind those industries down. Of course, that's a complex transition and it can't happen overnight and it has to happen with justice and with a lot of forethought and a lot of investment into the communities affected so that people continue to have work and better work. But it has to happen because the alternative is the devastation we're seeing all around us today.
And surely the Conservatives will suffer politically because isn't a big part of their constituency, the Country Party, the rural folk, they're the ones that have been most impacted. Farms and farmers have died. And
it's very hard to know how it expresses itself politically, certainly in terms of election, but you would have to think this is a fundamental crisis for those parties which have so supported climate denialism for so long. I mean, you had a leading government member on BBC 2 days ago denying any connection between climate change and these bushfires, whereas the senior firefighting chiefs, the people on the ground who fought fires for decades, are saying we've never seen fires like this in their ferocity, in their intensity, in their scale. And they're the ones calling for action on climate change, not environmentalists, not inner-city types. The actual people out there on the front line fighting the fires are saying this is about climate change and there has to be action on climate change.
And Australia surely can't get it both ways in the sense that they may not be the great emitters. And even Morrison himself quoted the Kyoto Protocol, saying that Australia's doing well within the bounds of that, which of course is largely irrelevant now. But still, if you send all your coal to China and it gets burned, it's in the atmosphere, which is causing global warming. So,
well, it's complete hypocrisy. As I said, by 2030, if all the planned projects are realised, as they will be, unless there's change, we will be the sixth largest producer of carbon emissions.
Right. So is that sinking in? Is the guilt or the responsibility sinking in to make the connection between the apocalypse that they're seeing in the air they can't breathe and the glowing horizon encroaching on them? Can they make that connection, do you think? Will they make that connection?
I think people are making that connection. You've got people, you know, up and down the eastern seaboard of Australia living in third world shanty towns without power, without drinkable water, without communications. This situation is going to go on for months. There are going to be other communities that get burned out. There are going to be more deaths, more tragedies. It's going to go on and on. So it will change, but I think I think you're seeing two things happening in Australia. This huge change in the mentality of the people recognising that climate change is a factor, that Australia is a guilty party in causing climate change. At the same time, you have the voices of coal beginning to fight back, and aided and abetted in Australia by the power of the Murdoch Press, which owns about 58% of all their newspapers and uses them in a sort of enforcer fashion. So anyone that speaks out on climate action, on these connections between Australia drying out, I mean, the fires are only one aspect. We've got huge problems with agriculture because of the nation's drying out. We've got towns all over Australia either having run out of water or soon to run out of water, with no likelihood for a long time of them having water. But this is a crisis of which the bushfires are the pointy end, but it's only one aspect of the crisis. But in all that, the Murdoch Press are deeply complicit in their promotion of a climate denialist agenda, and that they are as guilty as anybody. I mean, in one sense, Australia is a vast crime scene, and there are guilty parties, and the Murdoch Press is one of them. They should be so ashamed of their role in this. You know, it's been appalling, and really they need to change, you know, their stance on this issue, because it's not really about politics at all. It shouldn't be about that. This is about our survival as a people. It's a fundamental issue.
Well, maybe some of our listeners here in Los Angeles can protest in front of Rupert Murdoch's vineyard in right here in Bel Air, which actually recently a fire came all the way up to the vineyard and almost burned it down. So he's almost been scorched by the reality of climate change. But for the American audience, just in closing, Richard Flanagan, what you're telling us, the domination of the Murdoch Press, and of course they do have influence over television as much as they do over printed newspapers, the idea would be that in this country, about 60% of the media in this country was just like Fox News. That would get people's attention to get to understand how much Australians are propagandized.
They're propagandized on the one hand, and they've just been fed lie after lie after lie about climate change. And on the other hand, anybody, you know, any scientist, any public figure, any journalist, anybody who seeks to simply speak the truth about what is happening has their character fundamentally attacked. You know, whether it's a fire chief, whether it's a senior scientist. The most terrible thing about these fires is that Australia's own scientists predicted that climate change would lead to these bushfires back in the mid-1980s. There's a wonderful national government organisation, for scientific research called the CSIRO, and their scientists predicted all that has subsequently happened. From 1996, the Australian Conservative governments began working to subvert any action on climate change. These people, our leaders, betrayed our country, and they've been betraying it for over a quarter of a century. and now we're living with in the ashy ruins of that betrayal. That great, great black betrayal.
Well, Richard Flanagan, I thank you very much for joining us from Australia.
Thank you, Ryan.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Flanagan, who's an Australian novelist from Tasmania, considered by many to be the finest Australian novelist of his generation. According to The Economist, each of his novels have attracted major praise and received numerous awards and honours, including the 2014 Man Booker Prize, and his latest novel is First Person, and he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Australia is Committing Climate Suicide. And that was Background Briefing from January the 8th of this year with Richard Flanagan. As today we look back on the stories we covered this year, focusing today on climate change and its impact on the environment. And after a brief station break, we'll be back with more of Background Briefing's retrospective on the major stories of 2020.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart, I have...
Welcome back to this retrospective on Background Briefing's coverage of the impact of climate change on the environment in 2020. We are now going to an interview from August the 26th, when we looked into the wildfires in the West, with more dry lightning storms in the forecast, which have proved deadly in spite of the fact that these many devastating fires are not driven by winds. Another factor in making the task of battling the many fires more difficult is the lack of prison labor due to the pandemic having hit prisons in California, depleting the ranks of firefighters. Joining us is David Wallace Wells, a national fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor and climate journalist for New York Magazine. His latest book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, and he joined us to discuss his article at New York Magazine, California Has Australian Problems Now, and we assess what can be done to mitigate the twin crises of wildfires and housing shortages, as well as the acceleration of global warming caused by the fires, which release 9 times more CO2 into the atmosphere than all the reductions of CO2 emissions as a result of California's green initiatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Wallace Wells.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you. And when you say that California has Australian problems now, I mean, recently in Australia, 72,000 square miles were burned, killing several billion animals and pushing a number of species to extinction or to the brink of it. So that was pretty dramatic. I guess the difference is that in Australia, the political leadership is quite reactionary. The Prime Minister doesn't believe in global warming, or perhaps he's changed his mind. And the Rupert Murdoch press kept suggesting that the fires were all a result of arson. And in fact, the only reason the Conservative government is in power in Australia is because a coal baron ran a alternative third party to cut into the Labor Party vote. And that's how the Conservative born-again Christian Scott Morrison is now the Prime Minister. So that's not a description of Gavin Newsom's California. So is there a political dimension to this?
Well, I think there's a lot that could be done to manage forest fires much more effectively in California. But a lot of those decisions are really difficult to make. To begin with, much building in the state has taken place in really vulnerable, high wildfire risk areas, in part because housing policy in desirable parts of the state, say urban San Francisco, the Greater Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Diego, is so restrictive that the people who are trying to come to the state for the opportunities that it offers have to find housing elsewhere. And more of that building is being done in quite dangerous zones. So this is, it's a sort of a window into one aspect of, liberal hypocrisy about some of this stuff. I mean, I'm a progressive myself. I support, I'm an admirer of Gavin Newsom's and in general of the climate policy of California. But one aspect of their problems has to do with the unwillingness to develop areas that are today expensive, desirable neighborhoods in expensive, desirable cities. And there is a sort of core NIMBYism at work that is driving a lot of the development that pushes building into these dangerous areas. Of course, there's also the matter of forest management, which Donald Trump has talked about when he's been dismissive of the climate aspects of wildfires. And it is the case that probably, you know, there are alternative approaches to managing California forests that would make them less vulnerable to the kinds of devastating fires that we've seen this year and in 2018 and 2017 and many more times over the last few decades than we'd like to see. On the other hand, climate change is happening independent of all of those factors and is making whatever we do with forest management is making the basic underlying conditions of the state much, much worse, much more, you know, but much more receptive to, or, you know, much more vulnerable to these kinds of outbreaks. We've seen at least a doubling of the average wildfire burn since the 1980s in California. The wildfire season is now 50 days longer than it was just a few decades ago. And those trends are going to continue into the decades ahead, such that by 2050, scientists don't even know how to model what wildfire will look like in California because they believe so much of the state will have burned by that point. They can't make reasonable projections about what sort of ecology will grow back in the aftermath of those fires and can't say how flammable it will be. This is one reason why when I wrote a long piece about California fires, a long feature last year, Eric Garcetti, the mayor of LA, said to me, there's nothing we can do to stop this. We can't buy enough fire engines. We can't buy enough helicopters. We can't hire enough firefighters. The only thing that's going to stop this is when the climate settles back into something, a more normal, stable state. And he said that isn't likely to happen for many centuries. So California is going to be dealing with these issues going forward, and they're only going to be getting worse. We can make choices to make political choices to make living in that state under these conditions a little better, but ultimately we're going to be doing battle with this no matter what political choices we make. It is that significant a development in the climate and the ecology of the state, and we won't be able to turn back the clock on it anytime soon.
And again, I'm speaking with David Wallace Wells, a national fellow at the New America Foundation and columnist and deputy editor and climate journalist for New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. And he has an article at New York Magazine, California Has Australian Problems Now. Of course, another one of the problems California has is that there's been so much COVID-19 infections in the state prisons that the normal reliance on state prisoners to help with the firefighting is not working this time. And I believe that the actual union for the firefighters union, they don't actually like the program itself. So is that a factor here or a minor one?
I would say it's a factor, but a minor one. The truth is that, you know, the firefighting force is smaller than it usually is. In part, that's because of dynamics you describe. First of all, that a lot of prisoners who in normal years would be enlisted in the fight were released to, you know, sort of avoid the spread of COVID in prisons. And there are also other restrictions in place and how people can move around and be reaggregated and reassigned and that sort of thing because of the pandemic. So things are obviously much harder because of the disease conditions that we're doing this under. But the truth is that program, you know, we really shouldn't be depending on prison labor to fight these absolutely catastrophic fires. We should find a way to be able to fund a sufficient firefighting force to handle the kind of fires that we're going to be dealing with without doing so in such an exploitative way where we're, you know, putting people on the front lines and paying them as much as, you know, as little as a dollar a day to face down fires. On the other hand, you know, the most intense fires that California sees typically are largely the result of really powerful winds, Santa Ana winds and Diablo winds, the fires we've seen this year are not the result of those. They're just because there have been so many lightning strikes in the state. But when you have a fire that's powered by these really powerful winds, there's practically speaking nothing that firefighters can do to stop them. In fact, California firefighters have never stopped a wildfire that's been powered by Santa Ana winds in the entire history of the Cal Fire program. All you can do when that wind picks up is just to wait for it to die down again. I think what we're seeing this year is illustrative in the sense that these absolutely catastrophic fires, the second and third biggest in state history, both of which are just around the Bay Area, are not the result of winds. So in theory, you know, and we may see in the weeks and months ahead, things could actually get considerably worse from here. But already Cal Fire is stretched so thin, not just because of the lack of prisoner firefighters, but just because of the sheer number of lightning strikes and fires that they're fighting. Just over the last couple of weeks, they've had or 10 days, I should say, they've had as many as 12,000 lightning strikes in the state, producing 500 or more fires. And the Cal Fire, which is, you know, the department that looks at this and tries to fight it, is not even, you know, recording many of the smaller fires because they simply don't have the resources to do that. They're just concentrating on the several really biggest complexes, none of which are even 50% contained at the moment. So this is a department that is, it's a massively well-funded department. They've got an annual budget of $2 or $3 billion, which they regularly exceed and get bailed out by the federal government. They have enormous resources, and yet those resources are already today in 2020 woefully inadequate to the task of fighting the fires that we're seeing. And when you factor in a likely doubling or quadrupling of the amount of land being burned in the decades ahead, it tells you just how much more resources will have to be devoted to fighting these fires if we have a hope of protecting the citizens of California from the kinds of wildfire they're likely to see in the next few decades.
So I don't know whether there's any mitigation that can be done in terms of building materials for homes, clearance of brush, etc., and perhaps limiting the population that comes to California. I don't know that anything like that is necessarily on the agenda or even possible.
But a lot of the solutions are, they do help, and they are already being implemented to certain degrees. You know, building codes that reflect an evolving understanding of what homes can be protected. There's a movement to remove some of the most flammable plant life, especially, you know, in a sort of backyard setting, which would make houses, more safe to live in. And as I mentioned earlier, there is some movement to try to redefine some of the housing regulations to allow more dense building in the parts of the state where people really want to live, so that they don't need to live out in the wildland urban interface where these fires can really damage you. On the other hand, there is a sort of a limit to how much those policies can do when you have such a dramatically transformed climate and a state that is by nature it's a fire state. I mean, you know, before Europeans arrived in California, we had as many as 8 times as many fires as we have today. So this natural landscape is, you know, in some sense meant to burn. It's designed to burn. The question is how we can figure out ways to live among that fire, live amidst that fire without risking our own lives or quality of life in the sense of air pollution, which is proving so catastrophic already.
So in terms of mitigation, of course, there's nothing happening in terms of dealing with climate change, certainly with the Trump administration, and mitigation in itself is almost an admission that we've lost the battle. But these fires and the ones that are going on in Siberia as well, don't they add to global warming?
Yeah, it's a quite horrible irony of these fires generally, that, you know, a tree is sort of like a piece of coal. It stores carbon, and when it burns, carbon is released. So every time there's a wildfire, more CO2 is released into the air. In addition to the direct horrifying climate impact of the fire itself, you're adding to global emissions and ultimately raising global temperatures by some amount. And, you know, that may seem like a sort of trivial or marginal aspect of this issue. But in fact, it's quite significant. In 2019 was an exception, but both in 2018 and 2017 in California, the fires were so widespread that they were they totally wiped out all of the emissions gains that all of the state's green energy policies and fuel efficiency standards had achieved. In fact, in 2018, more than 9 times more carbon was released by the fires that year than had been eliminated from the state's carbon footprint through their green energy policies. So the green energy policies was able to make some difference in the state's emissions footprint, but the wildfires, added 9 times as much carbon as those gains represented. And that is a really terrifying, what scientists call feedback loop here, which is that as the planet warms, we're likely to see many more fires, each of them adding more carbon to the atmosphere, all of which together will only raise the temperature higher and produce yet more fires. So we're already in this kind of dangerous, spiral, and things are only going to get worse from here. As I said earlier, there are some things that can be done. You know, traditionally, historically, both the indigenous population of California and indeed a lot of earlier forest management in the 19th century and early 20th century focused on what's called controlled burning, where you actually do let forests burn as they would have in a natural state, but you sort of pinch off that flame so that it doesn't damage any area that's been developed and doesn't represent a real threat to the people living in that state. There was a big turn away from that in the middle of the 20th century, which has left the entire American West with much more effectively dry kindling than it would have had otherwise. And we can get back to that to some extent. The problem is a state like California is already so densely populated, and much of that building has come in these really dangerous areas. I think half of the building since the year 2000 has come in extreme high-risk wildfire areas. That means that we're really limited in how much of that we can do. Other states more in the more inland West can do a bit more of it because they're much less densely populated. But California is an especially tricky spot because there are 40 million people living there. When we talk about, you know, the pre-Columbian experience of the state having 8 times as many fires, they had probably about 500,000 indigenous people living there. So we're talking about, you know, as many as 80 times more people living in that same region. And you just can't do as much controlled burning given that as you might hope to.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, one of the other horrifying aspects of global warming and the acceleration of it, and you just mentioned that for all of the green initiatives here in the state of California to combat climate change and global warming, the fires have added 9 times more CO2 than you'd saved through these initiatives. The one thing that I think we can do something about, but it doesn't appear, and certainly the Trump administration is not helping, is the amount of methane that's coming out of the fracking business. The fracking business is going out of business now, but as these guys go out of business because of the price of oil, et cetera, having dropped so much, and solar is now even more competitive than natural gas, I understand, that market's collapsing. And these frackers are just abandoning these wells, which are just belching methane, which is like 100 times worse than CO2.
Yeah, methane is in a short term way it's much more damaging than carbon dioxide, but it also dissipates much more quickly. So one of the really worrying things about CO2 is that it hangs in the atmosphere for literally centuries, which means we're never gonna, you know, the stuff that England was putting into the air in the 18th century, we're still dealing with the global warming implications of that. And every ounce of CO2 that we put into the air today, we're going to be dealing with those implications for centuries from now. Methane is a little bit different in the sense that it dissipates much, much, much more quickly on the timescale of maybe months, maybe years, but certainly not decades or centuries. And that means that theoretically, if we were to sort of close off close off all of those valves and limit the release of methane from industrial areas, and if we were able to figure out a way to stop the natural release of methane, which is also accelerating, theoretically, we could also sort of turn the page on that chapter of the climate change story. I don't think that we're in a position to really be doing that across the board, especially because of the natural methane sources. But I do think it's possible that over the next few years, we start to respond a little more responsibly towards the industrial sources of it and take some kind of control over that that line driving some warming.
Well, I wish there was a big vacuum cleaner that could suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere. And
well, there are. They do have these machines. They're called direct air capture machines, and they're able to take carbon out of the air at a cost of about $100 a ton. There are very few of them. We haven't built them out at anything like the scale that we need. But the technology does exist. It's just a lot more expensive to take carbon out of the atmosphere than it is to avoid putting it up there in the first place. So probably that money would be better spent on decarbonization rather than what's called negative emissions. But, you know, the technology does exist. It's just, as with everything else with climate change, we're not deploying it at nearly the scale or with nearly the public policy and financial support that is necessary to really bring about this sort of wholesale change that we need to stabilize the planet's climate at anything like its present temperature.
Well, David Wallace-Wells, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Wallace-Wells, a National Fellow at the New America Foundation and a columnist and deputy editor and climate journalist for New York Magazine. He was previously the deputy editor of the Paris Review, and his latest book is The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. And he has an article at New York Magazine, California Has Australian Problems Now. And that was Background Briefing from August the 26th of this year with David Wallace-Wells, as today we look back on the stories we covered this year, focusing today on climate change and its impact on the environment. After a brief station break, we'll be back with more of Background Briefing's retrospective on the major stories of 2020. The firefighters hose me down. Welcome back to this retrospective on Background Briefing's coverage of the impact of climate change on the environment in 2020. And we're now going to an interview from September the 15th, when we looked into the worst possible leadership the country could have to deal with this challenge of climate change, as Trump ignored global warming and the record heat behind the massive fires across the West, suggesting out of thin air that, quote, it'll start getting cooler. At the same time, appointing a global warming denier in a key role involving the weather at NOAA. We spoke with Naomi Oreskes, a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Studies at Harvard University, the co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, and her latest Why Trust Science. She joined us to discuss her article at CNN, America's Devastating Divorce from Science. Welcome to Background Briefing, Naomi Oreskes.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And we saw the most extraordinary example of anti-science, science denial, global warming denial, denial of facts, truth, just pulling it out of thin air when an official in the state of California yesterday at a meeting in Sacramento between President Trump and Governor Newsom basically said, the temperatures are unbelievable. Record temperatures in Death Valley, and global warming is behind these massive fires burning across the West. And then Trump said, it'll get cool soon. Wait and see. Just wait. And then the official said, but that's not what science says. And Trump more or less said, you know, screw science. I can't remember exactly what he said. I'd never seen anything quite that blunt and hostile of you.
Well, that's a good question. We've seen an awful lot of things like that. There is a kind of belligerence and hostility in the current administration that does transcend the things we've seen before. So I'd say in terms of the content of the dismissal and disparagement of science, it's not really new. In terms of the tone and the attitude, yes, this takes it to yet a deeper, lower level of despair.
But do you have to put this in the broader context of faith over fact, that the people in his faith, and particularly the Christian right, which is a big part of his faith, they operate on faith, not necessarily fact. And then his followers, who just love to hear what they love to hear, that COVID-19 has gone away, everything is great. Is that what's happened? I don't know what kind of an infection rate it is in the consciousness of this country, but it's got to be around 30%.
Yes, it is. It's around 25 to 30% of Americans who reject scientific evidence on important issues like evolutionary biology, climate change, COVID-19, and the benefits of wearing masks. So we know that we are grappling with a significant minority. It's not the majority of the American people, so we can take a little comfort in that. It's not even close to a majority. I mean, it is actually a relatively modest slice, about a third or less, but it's a slice that's powerful and effective and important in part because of the asymmetries of our electoral system and in part because of the efficacy of our current president in mobilizing what I like to call belligerent ignorance. But I think the bigger answer to your question is, you know, as a historian, it's my job to put things into context. That's what I do. But the context I would put it in is not really a faith context, unless the faith you're talking about is the free market fundamentalism. What we've seen for the past 20 years or more is a rejection of scientific evidence that points out the failures of competitive capitalism. And this is the pattern that that Eric Conway and I documented in Merchants of Doubt. It's the pattern we talk about in the Collapse of Western Civilization. It's the pattern that we're working on in our new book, The History of the Ideology of the Magic of the Marketplace. Conservatives in this country, Republicans, business leaders of a certain stripe, have consistently refused to accept scientific evidence that points out market failure, that points to places where we need the government to do something. We can argue about what that something is. We can argue about emissions trading or carbon taxes or regulation or command and control, but we need to do something because the market doesn't do it on its own. In fact, the opposite. The market creates these problems through economic activity, but it doesn't really have a way to fix it, at least not on its own. And this is something that Republicans, going back to Ronald Reagan, have refused to accept. Now, Ronald Reagan was a kind of good-natured guy, so what he did didn't feel so horrible to most people. Over the last 40 years, the hostility has become more and more belligerent, more and more aggressive. And as I said in my piece that was published today, as the science has got stronger, the belligerence has also got stronger in response. So the more the scientific evidence builds up, the more we see certain people doing everything they can to deny it. And then what we see now, the new piece with Donald Trump, is then infusing it with this sort of hostility towards educated people, hostility towards scientists. And so, again, this is something I said in my piece today, really a kind of despising of scientists and intellectuals, dismissing them as elite or elitists. And, you know, it's kind of one of the tragedies of our time. The word elite used to be a compliment, right? To be an elite athlete is a good thing. To be elite is to be at a high level, something we should respect. But Trump and his cohorts group have turned it into a term of disparagement.
I think I should have said, instead of faith over fact, belief over fact. But still, when you talk about the work that you're doing on the market, does that mean that people simply can erase history, like they can erase the 1929 crash and the 2008 crash?
Well, yes, exactly. And that's a big part of actually what Eric and I are writing about right now, that One of the biggest, major, most important developments in the 20th century was the New Deal and the reforms that were put in place to capitalism, to labor practices, to finance and banking in response to the Great Depression, the largest economic calamity that had ever faced the United States and Western Europe and really the world. And, you know, what the Great Depression told us was that there were certain structural problems in the system that had to be addressed if we weren't going to have a complete economic collapse and see a quarter of the workforce displaced out of work. And so remedies were put in place. Now, were those remedies all perfect? No, of course not. They never are. But a lot of those remedies did work pretty well. And for a long time, through the 1950s, 60s, and into the 70s, both Republicans and Democrats agreed on the need for certain kinds of market regulations, workplace safety, occupational health, minimum wage, maximum hours, unemployment insurance, Social Security. There was a broad American consensus on these issues, but that began to break down in the 1970s. And then from the 1980s onward, we saw the sort of rise of an ideology, an anti-government ideology, which really threw away all the lessons of the Great Depression. And in this case, it wasn't just Republicans, it was Democrats too. The more I researched, the less impressed I am by Bill Clinton. Because a lot of the regulations that were put in place during the New Deal were actually undone in the Clinton administration. So there was a kind of amnesia, kind of forgetting of the lessons of history, and a kind of new faith. So I think in this case, the word faith is appropriate, faith in the markets to solve our problems. And now here we are again, where once again, we have a major serious crisis, although in this case, the crisis isn't so much an economic crisis, although there is obviously an economic component, but it's actually a scientific crisis. It's a crisis of the climate, and it's the crisis of COVID-19. And now what we see clearly is that if we don't address these scientific issues, then the economy suffers as well. And so now we're seeing the economy is, you know, a mess because we didn't deal properly with COVID-19. And we're seeing billions of dollars in damages in the American West from the wildfires.
Again, I'm speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the U.S. Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board. And she's the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscure the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And her latest book is Why Trust Science? And she has an op-ed at CNN, America's Devastating Divorce from Science. So your piece starts out with Vannevar Bush, who led the U.S.'s scientific mobilization during World War II and laid a blueprint. And of course, 75 years later, it's all sort of been, hasn't all gone away. But, you know, the National Science Foundation, NASA, the U.S. Geological Survey, and NOAA are some of the achievements here. And it's been a bipartisan effort for decades for both Republicans and Democrats to support science. But now, of course, you've got Trump really upping the ante in his pattern of putting the fox in charge of the hen house, or putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank, with this character that he's placed at NOAA, which is all about our weather. So he's put a global warming denier in there. And again, that feels like really an insult. It's really in your face.
It is. It's extremely in your face. And so I was invited by CNN yesterday afternoon to write something about it. And I found myself feeling like, well, what more is there to say? This just keeps happening over and over and over again. And every time it happens, scientists get outraged and scientists say how terrible this is and how it doesn't serve the interests of the American people to deny science. And so I started thinking, you know, another day, another outrage. So what do we do in the face of this constant barrage of outrages? And so I tried to step back from the immediate issue of, as you said, Dracula in the blood bank. I love that image. That's a much more potent image than the fox in the hen house, because these people are, you know, really sucking our blood, sucking us dry. So I started thinking about, well, why has all this happened? And why do the American people seemingly not care, right? Because when something like this happens, the scientific community gets up in arms, protests, speaks up, speaks to the media, but the average American person is not reacting to this. People are not taking to the streets to protest climate change deniers in position of power and authority in American government. And I think part of the reason, it's obviously is a very complex issue, but I think part of the reason is that the social contract between science and the American people has broken down. And that's what I tried to bring up in this piece, to say that there was an idea encapsulated by Vannevar Bush in his report, Science, the Endless Frontier, which was that America, the American people, through our tax dollars, would support science, and in exchange, science would support us. Science would give us medicine. Science would give us a better understanding of natural hazards like earthquakes and volcanoes. Science would give us better technology, the rise of computer science, computational power, the laptops that so many of us now have on our desks and cell phones, that we would benefit from supporting science. And there was broad agreement about this, broad consensus and broad support for this vision for, you know, quite a while, for the better part of, I don't know, about almost 50 years. But that social contract has clearly broken down. Many American people don't believe in the results of science, don't accept the results of science, and others, maybe they do, but they don't necessarily look to scientists for leadership, and they don't realize or understand why it is so terrible that a climate change denier could be put into a high-level position at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And so what I wanted to highlight in this piece was that scientists are still operating as this is, as if this is business as usual, as if we just keep defending science, somehow it'll get sorted out. And I think it's deeper than that. I think this is telling us that we really need a new story, a new narrative, a new vision about what the relationship of science is to the American people. And I don't know what that new vision is. It's rare for me to write a piece in which I end by saying, I don't know what the answer here is, but I know we need to do something because what we've been doing isn't working.
Well, clearly the thread seems to me to be, Naomi Oreskes, is propaganda, whether it's the propaganda from Fox News that keeps that 30% inside the bubble of delusion where they're immune to facts and information. And it's corporate propaganda, for example, that said smoking is okay, you know, and it's corporate propaganda from the Koch brothers and others that global warming is a hoax. So aren't we up against big money here? It's that simple, isn't it? And that mendacious?
Well, I think what you said is true, but I'm not sure if it's that simple. So Absolutely, corporate propaganda is a huge part of the story. And this was one of the things that Eric Cohen and I wrote about Emergence of Doubt, the way the fossil fuel industry, following the model that had been established by the tobacco industry, propagandized the American people to think that we didn't really know if climate change was happening, or we didn't really know if it would be damaging, or even today that we, as if we don't really know that it's causing wildfires when in fact we do, just as the tobacco industry before them had cast doubt on the science linking smoking to cancer and other diseases. So corporate propaganda and the dark money behind it is a huge part of this story. We've been sold a bill of goods, and many of us are, as a result, confused, which was exactly the point of it, to confuse us. But I also think there's another component, which is, I guess, what we could call a values component, that if we look at public opinion polls, we ask people, what are the most important issues that they vote on? Almost no one will say that they would vote for a candidate who makes a high priority to support American science. I mean, only scientists would say yes to that, pretty much, and a few other, maybe some of the people who read my column in Scientific American, but it's just not a high value for most Americans. And I think that's in part because a lot of Americans don't actually understand why science matters to them. They don't understand or see what the added value is in their lives. Now, COVID-19 has given us an opportunity to address that. And I think the scientific community has done a pretty good job in this case. I think Anthony Fauci has been quite amazing. But I think we have to do a lot more and to really explain to the American people, here's what science does for you. So if you think about the old John F. Kennedy line about ask not what your country can do for you, the American people have the right to ask, well, what does science do for me? And I think scientists need to do more to answer that question. So not just to give people facts and good information, that's really important. We absolutely do need good information. But in addition, we need to know, how does this information matter to me? How does it affect my life? And we do have the opportunity to do this now, because with these wildfires and the smoke and Hurricane Sally and all of these things, there is a terrific opportunity here to explain to the American people how science matters to their lives, their livelihoods, the safety of their communities. And I think some scientists have done that. We certainly have some scientists who've been quite heroic in doing that, but I think we need to do much, much more.
Well, just in the last minute, is this a one-sided war, though, where the anti-intellectuals and anti-science people have declared war on knowledge and fact? And I have a friend who's won the Nobel Prize quite recently, and he's kind of angry at Fauci and all of those scientists that have been involved with this administration. He feels that they should have all en masse quit a long time ago and started a resistance movement. Yeah. Are scientists capable of becoming kind of guerrillas, activists? Because maybe that's what we need. We need toughness has to fight the lack of reason.
Well, that's a great question. And I'd love to have you invite me back to have this conversation with your Nobel laureate friend, because I think it's a really, really big question. And I've thought a lot about how, you know, the choices that Anthony Fauci has made. I think I understand what he's doing. He feels that he can do good in that role, and he wants to do the good that he's able to do. So I don't criticize him for that. But I also sympathize with the argument that there comes a point in which you simply have to draw a line in the sand and say, no, this isn't acceptable. And how we figure that out, I think, is a very, very tricky issue. I would say, though, it is a David and Goliath kind of story because so much of the money is on the other side. But we do have one really important thing on our side, and that is that we have the truth.
Well, Naomi Oreskes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary science at Harvard University. She received the Young Investigator Award from the National Science Foundation, served as a consultant to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and was a consultant to the United States Nuclear Waste Technical Review Board, and is the co-author with Eric Conway of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. And her latest book is Why Trust Science? And she has an op-ed at CNN, America's Devastating Divorce from Science. And that was Background Briefing from September the 15th of this year. As today we look back on the stories we covered in 2020 about climate change's impact on the environment. I'm Ian Masters, and this has been Background Briefing. And in these last days of 2020, we will look back tomorrow with a retrospective on our coverage of the Black Lives Matter protests in response to police killings and racial injustice. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by